Harrisburg to Latrobe, Punxsutawney to Pittston, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Tom Wolf continues to push a radical environmental agenda, bypassing the legislature in favor of regulatory fiat. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business and Rachel Gleason of the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance for a Capitol Watch discussion. And voters in Iowa and New Hampshire have had their say, but the Pennsylvania primary still months away. Should our primary be moved to an earlier date? I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to David Taylor and our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. A dispute over the certification of the Express Vote XL touchscreen voting system, slated to be used by 17% of voters statewide this year, is being challenged in federal court. The ongoing suit has been filed by lawyers for former Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who are attempting to have the machines decertified for the upcoming November general election. The suit heated up after other groups objected to its use due to problems that plagued the system in Northampton and Philadelphia counties last year. Most Pennsylvanians will vote on new systems this year due to an executive order by Governor Tom Wolf mandating a paper backup trail be in place. Rollout of new voting systems caused numerous problems in last November's election, raising concerns over the vote in this, a presidential election year. Budget hearings are now underway in Harrisburg, this in the aftermath of Governor Tom Wolf's fifth budget address, which, like the first four, called for massive increases in state spending. And like the past 4 years, most of the governor's proposals are dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled General Assembly. Once again, the governor is seeking to place more taxes on the energy industry. This despite the fact state revenues are exceeding projections. The governor plans to spend that additional money. He's proposed a $36.1 billion state general fund budget for the 2020-2021 fiscal year, which begins July 1st. And Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman may face a lawsuit over his blocking of followers on his Twitter account. Cumberland County Attorney Mark Scaringi, representing two individuals who were blocked, claims the Lieutenant Governor's actions violated their First Amendment free speech rights. Fetterman has countered, saying it's his personal Twitter account. But such accounts have been the subject of disagreement when it comes to elected officials, with followers claiming that places their accounts in the public realm. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Tom Wolf has taken dead aim on the energy sector, proposing to embroil Pennsylvania in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and the Transportation Climate Initiative, two radical plans that would increase energy costs for all Pennsylvanians. Here with an update are our Capitol Watch crew, Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business, Rachel Gleason from the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance, and David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, my dear friend, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me again, David. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, I want to talk about, you know, there are always so many bad ideas kicking around in Harrisburg, but there's a new one that I think people need to be made aware about. And I think you actually testified on this recently.
Yes.
That they call it the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's a club we don't want to belong to because it's a carbon tax. It's a tax on the energy sector to make our electricity more expensive.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI, R-G-G-I for short.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something the governor is proposing to sign Pennsylvania on to. It's currently 10 northeastern states that participate in this carbon cap and trade program where energy producers that produce carbon dioxide as a part of their energy production process would have to purchase allowances on a market for each ton of carbon they emit.
And the thing is, we're talking here about businesses that are within the allowable limits under the EPA and DEP. So these are businesses that are in compliance with the law, but the Governor Wolf wants to move the goalposts again. So to walk us through what the real world impact of this would be, I want to welcome our special guest, Rachel Gleason, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance. Rachel, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, this is a serious business here, and I'd like, if you would please, Rachel, can you explain to the listeners what the impact would be on Pennsylvania if the governor gets his carbon tax?
Well, I mean, it's a really complicated scenario, and as Rebecca mentioned, Reggie's in 10 states, primarily New England, but Pennsylvania participates in a regional transmission organization called PJM, which are an entirely different set of states. So when you participate in this regional transmission organization,
that's the electricity market.
Yes. The goal is to provide the least cost energy, electricity, to the residents of that organization. So electric suppliers have to bid into a market, and what this would do is, just for Pennsylvania electricity suppliers, it would give them an extra tax on their generation. So other states like Ohio and West Virginia that participate in that same area wouldn't have that tax, but yet would bid into the same market, making Pennsylvania's generation uncompetitive and more expensive.
Which just seems crazy, because Pennsylvania, with our energy abundance, that should be a competitive advantage for us.
Indeed. And I think, I mean, you would know better than any that a lot of manufacturing has located in Pennsylvania because of our affordable electricity.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think that distinguishes us from other REGI states, other states that are part of REGI right now, in that we have an abundance of natural gas here in Pennsylvania, and we are producing energy at less expensive rates. In fact, a lot of those REGI states are buying Pennsylvania energy.
Well, and even as, yes, with the natural gas revolution, that new capacity is coming online that's powered by natural gas, that we still have, you know, a very meaningful contribution to Pennsylvania electricity from coal. Pennsylvania has an enormous amount of coal. And, you know, after the Obama administration gave the coal industry a good hard shove, that what we have that remains, these are the companies that made the massive upgrades to be in compliance with the tighter federal standards. It just seems grotesquely unfair that Governor Wolf wants to punish them again.
And that's correct. I mean, the coal plants that are left in Pennsylvania have invested, you know, upwards of $1 billion per plant to comply with the federal regulations, and this just happened a couple years ago.
Yes.
So, you know, they made those investments to stay in operation, to better their controls, and now are going to be faced with, you know, another unfair disadvantage.
And so, Rachel, the remind me, the percentage of Pennsylvania's electricity that comes from coal, what is that today?
Specifically in Pennsylvania, within our state lines, it's about 18% from your traditional bituminous thermal coal and 2% from waste coal.
Okay.
But in the PJM, Regional Transmission Organization, it's about 30% from coal.
The way that this carbon tax works is that the state's bank credits for making reductions in emissions. And in fact, Pennsylvania has reduced emissions by a greater percentage and by a greater volume than have the states in the REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And so for Pennsylvania to come in now, it's very much like the last person showing up at the party getting stuck with everybody else's bar tab. Like, it's a total chump move. And it just, again, it just blows my mind that the governor would want to do this.
Yeah, we've exceeded expectations on reducing our carbon dioxide emissions. And this would also arguably increase CO2 in the long run because, as I mentioned, Pennsylvania electric producers would be at a disadvantage in the PJM market. So generators in Ohio and West Virginia would simply just ramp up their generation and perform more. So it wouldn't really reduce CO2 as much as it would displace it to Ohio and West Virginia.
At the cost of Pennsylvania jobs.
At the cost of Pennsylvania jobs. There's a great number of employees at these plants, at these power plants. It takes a lot of man hours to operate these, and even when they are in down seasons, there's a lot of maintenance that's done on the plants. So there's a good number of union jobs that that are at these plants that would be jeopardized if this were implemented. You know, in talking to the generators, they say that they will shut down. So if they shut down, those jobs clearly would go away. Outside that, it's not just about power generation, as it is also about coal jobs.
Yes.
Pennsylvania is the third largest coal-producing state in the nation, and a good amount of our coal mined goes to these plants. And then when you factor in the rail jobs that transports this coal to the plants, the numbers it's a domino effect.
Yes. Yeah. And again, these are plants where the owner-operators have invested enormous sums to upgrade them to make them compliant with the strictest state and federal standards.
One of our concerns with the coal plants specifically is, as you said, they're going to have a lot of trouble competing. Should this go into effect? If those coal plants go out of business, I'm worried not just about the, employees directly at the coal plants. Obviously, that's an issue. But what about all the small businesses, the consultants, the trucking companies, the, mom and pop grocery shops, all those businesses that are part of that community that are also going to suffer? It's not just the plant itself. It's the entire community. And I think we have to consider that, the impact of that. Energy is about 50, in 2018, I think it was 51% higher, the cost of energy in the Reggie states, as it was in Pennsylvania.
Yikes.
So for a small business, many of whom are energy intense, if you think about, I know big manufacturers, most of them are very energy intense, but there's a lot of small businesses that also are energy intense too.
Well, sure.
So anyone that has a refrigerator, as a part of their small business, or laundromats, things like that, those businesses are really going to see a huge increase in their energy costs, which are difficult for small businesses because they have a harder time absorbing those costs. So, for instance, if they have sunk costs in particular equipment, it's more difficult for them to replace it for more energy efficient equipment because they don't tend to have a lot of cash on hand.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania, and our special guest, Rachel Gleason from the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance. And so Rachel, getting back to why this carbon tax cap and trade scheme is bad for Pennsylvania. It's also really alarming that, essentially you have the executive, the governor, assuming the powers of the legislature in imposing a tax that, it seems as though the governor intends to assert this through his regulatory authority. And this is a really dangerous thing. I mean, one of the whole purposes of the separation of powers is so that our leaders can't act unilaterally. Do you think if the governor attempts to proceed with this, that you think that we'll have to fight it in court?
I think it would probably eventually go down that road if he's successful in proceeding with it. Usurping the oversight of the General Assembly and separation of powers, and when you have a mechanism that would generate as much revenue as he purports it will generate. I think that's a real problem when you have one elected official in government trying to tax all of Pennsylvania.
This is why actually all three of our organizations are part of a new business labor coalition called the Power PA Jobs Alliance, and folks can find it online at powerpajobs.com. And this is a surprising coalition because it isn't, as I said, it's not just the business side, the employer side, but it's, it's PMA and NFIB and the Coal Alliance, but it's also the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and the mine workers and the Boilermakers and IBEW, and you can see the whole roster of participating organizations, in this effort to stop the carbon tax because of the hard hat jobs that it would destroy if it's implemented.
Bottom line, it's Power PA Jobs. This carbon tax, this effort to join Reggie, isn't about carbon because it won't actually reduce it. It will just, as I said earlier, displace it to other states with those jobs. So it would have a pretty far-reaching impact on Pennsylvania's economy, which is why I think it is so very important to folks like NFIB and PMA, but also the boilermakers and the building trades and the UMWA and all those folks that are worried about their jobs and their family sustaining jobs. I mean, these are high paying jobs. They make over $100,000 a year on average. You know, these are serious family sustaining jobs, and they would be threatened by, you know, Pennsylvania's participation in RGGI.
And I really don't think, to David's point about the governor doing this unilaterally, I really don't think that any consideration has really been given to those costs. There's a very real cost to our families, to our communities. We're talking, you know, probably thousands of jobs and billions of dollars of impact, potentially.
And also that it's concentrated, as I understand it, that the facilities we're talking about are mostly in, you know, Indiana and Armstrong and Cambria counties. And that, you know, and again, the small town life, that these are major employers, and to lose these jobs for no good reason, that would just be devastating to these communities.
And David, beyond that, PCA, our membership, and probably overlays with some of your membership as well, and yours, Rebecca, we aren't just the producers of coal. We're also the environmental firms and the manufacturers and the machinists and the welders that support the mines.
Yes.
So our membership is about 200 companies, but we touch 22 PA counties.
Yes.
So
yes,
we do have a large concentration. It's primarily in the western side of the state. But to your point, it's also very concentrated in Greene and Washington counties, where mm-hmm. there's a lot of longwall production. And those companies contribute millions of dollars in property taxes, which is, for us that work in the political space, the issue that never goes away.
Yes.
But, you know, if those jobs are threatened and those businesses are threatened, so those property taxes will go away. And then you have issues on the county level and school districts. I mean, again, with the domino effect.
But again, I think the domino effect goes even farther when we talk about increased energy costs that will come about as a result of RGGI. Because I saw the study that said that RGGI states lost 35% of energy-intensive businesses since RGGI went into effect. And in comparison, the comparison states involved only lost about 4% over the period of time that was studied. If we lost 35% of our energy-intensive businesses, I mean, I think agree that is terrifying. That's on top of the coal jobs and the communities that we've already discussed. So
for what we're chasing ghosts, as has already been established. Pennsylvania has lowered carbon emissions faster and to a greater degree and in a greater amount than the states inside the compact. So saying that we need to do this to reduce carbon is just nonsensical.
Well, I think when you talk about something with such a high cost, you have to consider what the benefits are, right? So we've already discussed the fact that we're already reducing carbon emissions. But even the proponents will tell you, in order for us to impact climate, because that's what they're ultimately trying, right?
Yes.
Global issue. They're ultimately trying to impact climate. Every state would have to make the same reductions, and probably every country in the world
this is the thing that people don't talk about. If you're concerned about, you know, extreme weather, global warming, climate change, climate chaos, whatever the euphemism of the day is,
right,
like, you're in the wrong country.
Yes, that's
you're
right.
In the wrong
yes.
country. That the United States is the most advanced, you know, cleanest, the highest standards, the greatest compliance. You know, you look at what's happening in China and India and Brazil and Russia. I mean, those countries have so much more that they need to do to modernize, to get right, to stop pollution. That turning the screws on our producers here, pushing us past the breaking point, is counterproductive. All we're going to do is you know, export prosperity and import smog. It's
right.
It's pointless. And I just, you know, actually, if we were concerned about this as a global issue, we would want all energy production and manufacturing to come to the U.S. because we would do it cleaner, safer, better, with lower emissions than anybody else would.
Yeah, that's right. And I also think we have to consider that in order to breed innovation in energy production and energy efficiency and things like that, we have to have a competitive economy that encourages innovation. And in order to do that, we got to maintain our, you know, a competitive price of energy, I think. Yeah. We're back to that.
And not to unnecessarily disadvantage one, right. One of the participants in the, you know, in the arena. And I mean, Rachel, I'm sure that the dawn of the natural gas revolution has put tremendous competitive pressure on your sector, and that your sector is attempting to, you know, to calibrate, to find, you know, new ways to keep up.
And it has. I mean, we compete directly with low natural gas prices, but we don't fault our, you know, fellow fossil fuels for them having low prices at the moment. I mean, you know, a decade ago, they were triple what they are today, and it's a fluctuating market. Would we love natural gas prices to go up a little bit to help our coal fleet? Of course, but that's not the case right now. The industry has really struggled in recent years. It's dwindled. We've taken a lot of hits, and this would just be one more punch.
Well, but it's one thing to, you know, to suffer these blows in response to changes in the marketplace. It's a whole different thing when these are changes that are being imposed by government that are not necessary.
Right.
And anyway, that's just what gets me out of shape.
Well, back to Rebecca's point, too. Beyond the cost of electricity and, you know, businesses, it's kind of counterproductive to increase your bottom line cost for businesses, but then expect them to be more efficient when it wouldn't be affordable.
And innovative, right?
And innovative when it wouldn't be affordable. But even beyond that, the consumer price of goods could go up.
I mean, which they inevitably will, that these costs always get passed along to the consumer one way or the other.
Which always, you know, and that also increases the cost of doing business, because then those cost increases go into the supply chain for any manufacturer or business. So we're just talking about cost increases across the board.
And this is one of the pressing issues of the day, and it's something that we will be revisiting as the year goes on. And unfortunately, this brings us down to the last of the time that we have for today's program. But Rachel, thank you so much for being with us. Hopefully you'll come back and visit with us again sometime. Until then, where can the listeners go to learn more about you and your organization and the work that you're doing?
Our organization is the PA Coal Alliance, and our website is www.betterwithcoal.com.
Betterwithcoal.com. Outstanding. Rebecca, where can the listeners go to find you?
We're at nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org or on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So for Rebecca and me, thanks again to Rachel Gleason for being our special guest. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Iowa and New Hampshire have had their say in the presidential nominating process. But Pennsylvania's turn in the national spotlight is months away. Often, but not always, the major party nominations are decided by the time voters in Penn's Woods trek to the polls. As happens every 4 years about this time, there is a debate over moving the Pennsylvania primary to an earlier date in the calendar. The debacle that occurred in the Iowa caucuses has added yet another dynamic to that discussion. While tradition certainly is on the side of Iowa and New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation status, there is merit to the argument that, demographically, neither are representative of the country as a whole. The opposite is true of Pennsylvania. Our state has two large cities, one with an eastern seaboard vibe, the other midwestern in nature. We have smaller cities, large suburban areas, and vast swaths of rural farmland. We are racially, ethnically, and culturally diverse. Pennsylvania is also one of a handful of swing states where the general election is truly competitive. It makes sense that Pennsylvania voters should have more of an impact on the selection of presidential nominees. To that end, State Senator John Gordner of Columbia County has introduced a bill that would move the Pennsylvania primary from the current date of the fourth Tuesday in April to the third Tuesday in March. That date, however, would still place Pennsylvania's balloting deep into the nominating process. Coming after Super Tuesday, which is typically the first Tuesday in March, the field of candidates would likely be winnowed to two or three, although that would potentially put our state in a position to deliver a knockout blow that narrows the field to one. Occasionally, even our late April balloting does impact the presidential nominating contest. In 2016, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich remained in the race, and Trump's win in Pennsylvania set up what was ultimately the clinching win days later in Indiana. In 2008, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton battled until mid-June before the nomination was settled, with Pennsylvania's voters helping to extend that contest. But those races were the exception rather than the rule. Add in the fact that presidential balloting in Pennsylvania is merely a beauty contest. No delegates are awarded based on the presidential vote, and the district-by-district delegate races are what really counts. Now it is likely Pennsylvania Democrats will find their voices do matter this year as that party's nomination process continues to unfold. Rule changes enacted since 2016 eliminate winner-take-all rules in various states that ensure proportional awarding of delegates, which will have the effect of keeping more candidates in the race longer. There are also financial and logistical challenges to moving Pennsylvania's presidential primary that have frustrated previous attempts to move the primary to an earlier date. In addition to presidential and delegate balloting, the primary also enables the parties to select their nominees for U.S. Senate, Congress, State Senate, and State House members. Earlier presidential balloting would either move those primaries up a month, or the state could hold a presidential primary in March and a primary for other offices the third Tuesday in May, as happens in other years. Staging two primaries, however, would be an expensive addition to the financial burden of counties. Increasing Pennsylvania's clout in the presidential nominating process might be worth the expense. But if so, it makes sense to hold the primary even earlier than the end of March, positioning the Commonwealth to be a major player while there are still larger fields of candidates from which to choose. This being Pennsylvania, it is likely nothing will happen again, but this is a debate worth having as we should reclaim our historical status as a Keystone State. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. And the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is just about a month away. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of grassroots conservatives every year here in the Keystone State. This year's conference will be March 27th and 28th at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz will be the featured dinner speaker. Also speaking, U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, Brent Bozell III from the Media Research Center, Congressman Scott Perry, John Gizzi of Newsmax, Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College, Kellyanne Pidgeon from Armed and Feminine, and many others. There will be panel presentations, workshops, and networking. For complete information and to register for the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, go to paleadershipconference.org. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WIOO-FM, Red 102.3, and WHYL-FM in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.